It's a particular pleasure for me as chairman tonight to welcome one of our most outstanding speakers, Adam Walker. He is also president of the Central London Lodge. And his subject tonight is the occult world, the Mahatma, Adam Walker.
Thank you. We all seem to be sitting comfortably, so I'll begin. The title of this evening's talk, The Occult World, has two significances for me, one general and one specific. In the most general sense, it is a term which signifies the whole inner side of nature and of man, occult meaning that which is hidden and not apparent. And there is in both of those, both in man and in nature, a hidden, not apparent side, which is in many respects of a greater significance than that which is apparent and that which is seen and that which we do immediately understand. The whole of theosophy, in a sense, is about such occult aspects in nature, not the marvellous, not the out of the way, not the secret, but the occult, the inner, the meaningful. But it also has a second significance, and that is that it's the title of a book written in the early 1880s by a man called Sinnett, and it is about the interaction, the dialogue, the communication that he had with certain rather startlingly different people that we term Mahatmas, or a term coined from the Indian tradition meaning just great souls, people of outstanding merit and quality and faculty. And it's a little bit about this story and about that communication that I want to spend some time on this evening. No doubt there are a number of you in the audience who are not too familiar with this aspect of the theosophical tradition, so I'd like to spend a little while to start with in talking a little about the background to these really momentous events. And one of the purposes of this evening's talk is to explain to you just why I see these events as quite so momentous and why, as time goes on, I think they will stand out in a historical perspective. Firstly, then, a little about the historical background. The Theosophical Society, formed in 1875, had its headquarters originally in New York. But in 1879, the founders, Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Olcott, moved from America via this country to India, arriving there in 1879. Their reputation had, to a degree, preceded them, a reputation culled in the world of spiritualism, with which area Madame Blavatsky had had quite a bit to do. So at the time they arrived in India, this reputation had preceded them. In India, the man to whom I have already made reference, Sinnett, was aware of spiritualism and psychism, had read much in the literature already, and when he heard that Madame Blavatsky was arriving, was immediately interested in her and her works. Now, Sinnett was a man of some significance in British India at the time, and it's a good idea to have just some little idea as to his position. He was the editor of a influential periodical in India called The Pioneer. It was probably the leading publication at the time, a weekly periodical, something perhaps akin to something like the New Statesman today, I would think, in which articles of some significance on the arts and sciences and whatever else were being considered. Also, it was political in nature, in that it was used to some extent as a mouthpiece for the British Raj. Some standing in the community, whose opinion was of some significance. So to have such a man as Synod interested in the incipient Theosophical Society as it then was, would have been quite a catch for the two founders. So when he, fairly early on in the piece, invited them to come and visit him in Allahabad in India, they agreed, the founders agreed very readily to do so. And there started in 1879 a friendship and a dialogue which was to continue certainly until Madame Blavatsky's death. The meetings that they had were firstly, as I said, Allahabad, which was then one of the main administrative centres from which the paper was run, and later up in the Himalayas in Simla, which is about 7,000 feet up in the foothills of the Himalayas. And in both of these places, Synod had his homes, where the summer residence, the winter residences, and so forth. And Madame Blavatsky stayed with him there for extended periods of time. Now, Synod primarily was interested in her because of her knowledge of spiritualism and psychism. He had read her first book, Isis Unveiled, the only one which at the time she had written in America to counteract the tendencies of spiritualism at the time. His interest was frankly that of a spiritualist, and his initial reason for inviting her and for talking to her is that he had heard that she was capable of producing at will the same sorts of psychic phenomenon that one was to encounter in trance conditions in spiritualistic seances and the like. So he invited her to his home, and there began a series of conversations about the nature of the occult world, in the general sense that I mean it, about occultism in general, on which subject really he was a complete novice and a complete beginner, there being very little literature in those days on which one could base much knowledge. Even more than this, he was still interested in psychism and continuously was asking her to produce some psychic phenomena. Initially, she wouldn't produce very much for him. She would produce only a minor phenomenon, which is what they call a rap, which is to, as if a knocking noise, as if you would make it with your knuckle, as if on a door or a window or any hard surface, that sort of knocking noise, but to make it appear wherever in the room that the operator so designated, on on the top of your head, on a window pane, on the top of a piano lid, anything which would resonate. Now, such psychic phenomenon, if you have never come across such a thing before, and if you're seeing it being done in broad daylight, without any trance conditions, without any darkened rooms or anything like that, is in itself quite significant. But of course, endlessly repeated, it just becomes as mundane and as ordinary as anything else, so he clamoured for more. Over the period, various other relatively minor psychic phenomena. But as time went by, rather more dramatic things were produced. For instance, at a dinner party one evening, she said to the assembled company, "Would anyone like me to bring something for them?" So one of the assembled company, a lady, said, "Yes," and described a particular brooch. It was a woman's brooch to fit on a dress with, I believe, a ruby surrounded with some pearls and so forth, which was in her house several miles away. And so Madame Blavatsky went through the processes of what we would now say apporting, bringing it at a distance, and lo and behold, she said, "You'll find it in the flower bed outside," and there, wrapped in a piece of paper, was indeed this brooch. Now, without going into the ins and outs of it, and without trying to justify the rights and wrongs and so forth as to whether it was genuine or whatever else, I'm just using this as an indicator as the sort of things which were being done at this particular time. As the meetings went on, even more dramatic, one of the most famous, the so-called cup and saucer incident. They were out having a picnic up in the hills, and again, quite unprompted, she said, "What would you like?" And one of them said, well, how about producing a cup and saucer to match the set that we have here, that they were using for the picnic, and she said it very well. And shortly afterwards said, well, if you dig under the roots of this particular tree here, you will find the cup and saucer. Well, it was a very difficult place to find, because indeed it was thickly covered with the roots of this particular tree. And after much hacking away with penknives and so forth, getting through the roots of the tree, lo and behold, they found the duplicated cup and saucer, which, it was later established, it would have been very difficult to have obtained where they were in Simla, and especially since the whole thing was completely unexpected and not at her suggestion. Now, this sort of thing was produced rather reluctantly. It was produced because Sinnett was interested in psychism, and because clearly he expected some sort of demonstration of psychic, or what we might now call occult, power. These, however, were regarded by Madame Blavatsky, and indeed her inspirers, the Mahatmas, as being frankly trivial. Demonstrations merely to satisfy the curiosity. And this sort of to satisfy the curiosity is something which would only be indulged in under the most important. Now, in Sinnett's case, as we've seen, he was a man in a position to influence public opinion, and to a man whose opinion would carry weight. And so I think for these reasons such psychic phenomena were condoned rather briefly. It was as a result of these meetings and the psychic phenomena that he observed that in part he wrote his first book called The Occult World, as I say, published I believe in 1882. And it was what you might now say an instant bestseller. Remember, we're talking about a time when none of the sort of occult literature that we can all lay our hands on at every bookshop from W. H. Smith onwards, none of that existed. His book was one amongst a very small number of books on this sort of subject, and describing as it did his acquaintance with these forms of psychic phenomena, and indeed more, which I'll come to in a minute, it inflamed public curiosity to enormous extent, and was certainly instrumental in the early growth of interest in this society. But probably the most significant aspect of what was happening during these two meetings between Madame Blavatsky and the Sinnetts was that all along Madame Blavatsky had been saying, it is not just I who produce these things, I have been trained to do this by my teachers, my instructors, the philosophy is more important than any of the psychic phenomena that I can produce for you. The purpose of the society, with its object of universal brotherhood, as we've heard this evening, all of these are of far more significance than the frankly rather trivial psychic phenomena which I can produce and will, merely to show you the genuineness of what we're talking about. Gradually some of this began to sink into Sinnett, and he began to realize that the inspirers of Madame Blavatsky, who at that time they referred to as the brothers, referring to a community, a fraternity, a brotherhood, shall we call it, of those who were well advanced in these aspects of occult nature. And eventually the idea evolved that he should try and get in contact with them and receive instruction from them himself. He eventually asked Madame Blavatsky that, supposing he wrote a letter, would she be able to transport it for him by occult means to her teachers? Her teachers living on the other side of the Himalayas in Tibet. And she said, well, she didn't know, but she'd ask. And through her own means, she did ask, and she received a rather qualified, cagey consent of one who said, yes, he would. So Sinnett had this letter transported And the very fact that he'd had a letter accepted so excited him that he wrote another letter before he'd even received the reply to the first one, the more clearly to set out what it was he wanted to say, and had that one sent off as well. Well, much to his surprise and delight, he did receive a long, long detailed letter back. And this was the beginning of a correspondence started in 1880, which continued more or less uninterruptedly for the next 5 or 6 years till 1885. These letters which he received back are what we collectively term the Mahatma letters to A.P. Sinnett. We are very fortunate that he kept them, preserved them. At his death, they were, through various agencies, finally passed on to the British Museum, as it then was, who thoughtfully bound them into 6 bound volumes, and they're kept in the Ancient Manuscripts Department now, and under certain circumstances are available for... So they're real documents, there's no question as to the fact that they exist, and so forth. The manuscript was eventually published in book form, and hence the title of the book, The Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnett. It's a slightly misleading title, because in fact there were 2 people that received the letters. Sinnett on the one hand, and another Englishman, a man called Alan Octavian Hume, who was at that time an official in the British government, was on the point of resigning from the government. But in the first year or so, he was actively involved in the society TS in India, and did indeed receive a number of letters from the same Mahatmas that Sinnett received his letters from. So that's a little about those. We'll come back to the letters in more detail as we go through. But what I'd like to stress at this stage is something of the uniqueness of this context, this contact that he had established. On the whole, it seems, if we review the history of this sort of contact with inner teachers, the contexts are, on the whole, secret. Where an individual has so merited contact from a teacher, an instructor, a guide, a guru, call it what you will, generally the relation is private. It is purely individual, as between teacher and pupil, and one of the conditions of accepting any instruction at all is that it should remain secret, and that you should not discuss it with other people, which is why the whole area of teacher-pupil relationship in the area of the occult sciences is so shrouded in mystery, and why so little generally can and is said. And the little aphorism, those who know do not speak, and those who speak do not know, generally reflects the true situation here. In this case, however, the first thing to say is that it was not kept secret. Even at the time, the contents of the letters that he received were published. In the book that he published, the first one, The Occult World, and in subsequent ones, he quoted extensively from the letters that he received. And you can check these out with the actual copies of the letters now published. But again, he was not the only one to receive letters. I've said he and Hume were the principal recipients. But if you look through the history of the period, you will find that there were probably conservatively dozens of people who were contacted at this time and who received letters in one form or another. Some received actual physical visits and were so favoured as to communicate with these people face to face. Others received notes, letters, instructions, and so forth. Most of this explosion of contact resulted from Sinnett's work, this book, The Occult World, as I say, inflamed, and I use this word advisedly, inflamed the interest of the community of psychics and mystics and so forth around the globe, many of whom, a number of whom anyway, travelled to India with the express intention of getting directly in contact with these teachers that Sinnett had written about in his book. And it had literally excited a frenzy of curiosity as to who they were, what their powers were, how they lived, where they lived, and everything. And there was this explosion of interest in finding out who they were. So the secrecy with which we normally associate this was not present. Now, the other thing which I believe is unique about this occurrence is that any number of people have come before the world and said that they have received teachings from inner guides, instructors, mahatmas, adepts, masters, one form or another, and have attempted to pass on this information to other people in written form or in personal instruction and so forth. I'm sure you can all think of examples of that for yourself. What is unique here is that there can be no doubt that the people who were, shall we say, the instructors of Madame Blavatsky genuinely did exist. There can be little doubt of their physical existence. It was not purely through Madame Blavatsky that knowledge of these people and communications with these people took place. Initially, it's true that as far as Sinnett was concerned, it was entirely through the agency of Madame Blavatsky. And as a result of that, needless to say, skeptics would say, and still do, believe it or not, that she wrote the letters, and that there were no masters, and that she was solely responsible for the whole thing from start to finish. Well, fairly early on, that particular idea was laid to rest. Sinnett had this sort of lingering doubt at the back of his mind. Was he being hooked? Was he being fooled in this respect? And was it really all Madame Blavatsky's doing? Well, they recognized that until his doubts were completely settled, he would not give himself wholly to this. So they established their independent existence in a rather startling demonstration, the significance of which even passed Sinnett by until it was actually pointed out to him, and he had his nose rubbed in it, so to speak. The way in which it took place was this, that he'd written a letter which was to be addressed to one of these Mahatmas, he at the time being in Allahabad, though I could be wrong. He had posted it to Madame Blavatsky for her to onward transmit to her Mahatmas. Now, we have the original of the letter that he sent, and we have on it the date and timestamp of which it was received in the town that she was staying at the time. On the same day, he received a telegram by way of reply from a town nowhere near, in fact some 700 miles from where Madame Blavatsky was, in which the obvious contents of the letter had been answered, and saying, it was a fairly short telegram, and saying the rest of your queries will be answered later. The point being that she couldn't possibly have been in two places at the same time and have written the reply to the telegram. Written the reply to the letter, and that the telegram as produced and as received by Sinnett on the same day that the letter arrived where she was proof positive that she hadn't written the reply or caused it to be written. So that was the thing which certainly convinced Sinnett. But thereafter, there were a number of people who have documented their contacts with these people, some, as I say, in face-to-face interviews, and some in terms of letters received. And although the principal volume that I've referred to, the letters of of Masters to A.P. Sinnett, is published, there are other letters published in other companion volumes. There are two volumes called Letters of the Masters of the Wisdom, Volume 1 and Volume 2, which are collations of various other letters received by quite a number of other people. In the initial period, Olcott received a whole series of letters from a variety of adepts and initiates, but there are others as well. So with this wealth of contacts and different sources. As I say, I think there is a uniqueness about the context in which this has all happened. Well, you may say, if they're that public, why don't they go one step further and do it all themselves? Why do they need to do it through intermediaries? Why do these adepts and masters not come forth and teach directly? Why do they have to use the sorts of intermediaries that we have with Madame Blavatsky and other people who perhaps we regard as being less than wholly satisfactory? Why couldn't they do it themselves? Let there be no mistake about the thing. Let them demonstrate their psychic and occult powers to us all. Let them teach us
well,
directly. The answers to this are interesting and very well worth studying if you intend to pursue this sort of subject at all seriously. Because in answering this, we have to look at a whole series of misconceptions that we have, firstly about the occult world in general, and secondly about those who have advanced into it and have acquired something of its knowledge and secrets and developed in that way. We too readily judge by our own standards as to how we think other people ought to behave, and we judge very largely by externals, and in this area par excellence this we must not do. Firstly, perhaps in a rather negative sense, look what happens when practitioners of the occult sciences do come before the world. We have for example in this particular area a number. People will quote you the names of Apollonius of Tyana, Cagliostro, and the Count of Saint-Germain, all of whom, it is said in this literature, were genuine initiates, had been trained in the occult sciences and knew exactly what they were talking about. Well, the first two that I mentioned were imprisoned by the authorities at the time, and the third, Count de Saint-Germain, would undoubtedly have been imprisoned if they could have laid their hands on him, but he disappeared mysteriously as he'd arrived just before he was about to be flung in prison. So much for coming before the public and showing what you can do, because the public doesn't want to know. And the public is frankly terrified by what it might actually find. Slightly at a tangent to this, but still very much to the point, in the very first letter the first pair of letters that were exchanged between Sinnett and the Mahatma with whom he'd been put in contact contained exactly such a point and such an argument. Sinnett, by now convinced of their existence and of the occult powers that it was within their power to exercise, had suggested an experiment which he said would be so convincing that it would, as he put it, close the mouths of the skeptics and that everybody would have to accept the genuineness of the occult phenomena. And what he was proposing to do was a simultaneous exercise whereby a copy of the Pioneer, his newspaper, should be produced in London on the day of its publication, and a copy of the London Times be produced in India on the day of its publication. Now, you'll appreciate that at the time, the quickest way of doing that would have been to have put it on a boat and to have ferried it from one place to the other, which would have taken about 3 weeks, I think, at the very quickest, and probably a good deal longer. So, had such an experiment been done, it would have been very dramatic. The very first letter that he gets back from Mahatmas opens with the sentence which says, precisely because the experiment would close the mouths of the skeptics, it is unthinkable. Now, that is a jolt straight away to Sinnett, and it's still a jolt when you think about it now. The reason that it's unthinkable is that they do not want to convince people in this sort of way. You do not want to tear people's eyes open in this rather unfortunate sort of way. It would upset and unsettle people to be forced to have your nose rubbed in something so that there was no room for doubt. And even if there was originally no room for doubt, people would soon find room for doubt in some way or another, and would suddenly manage to come up with ways in which it had been carried out, which were some sort of subtle confidence trick, and would have managed to discredit the whole thing in some way anyway. In the same letter, he goes on a little later on dramatically to say, in effect, that if they didn't believe you, your reputation would be in shreds anyway, which was not what Sinnott had in mind. And he said, if they did believe you, your life would be in danger. The way they put it, you wouldn't be able to walk around Hyde Park without getting killed, because it would have so inflamed people's sensibilities at the time. Well, perhaps we might think that we're a bit different now, and this is 100 years later, and we're a good deal more sophisticated in these sorts of matters, and it wouldn't really upset us in that sort of way. No, perhaps that sort of thing wouldn't upset us now, but no doubt we could devise other things which would be equally startling, and they would upset us in equally the same sort of way. Underlying this seemingly trivial point, there is much which lies hidden as to why they do not come and work in this sort of way. Why can't they come and be interviewed on television, we might think, and so forth. It's all a question, or very largely a question, of our expectations, what we know, what we understand, and what possible benefit we could in fact get from such a contact. As becomes clear from reading these letters, that which is the first object of our society, that of universal brotherhood, is the one driving, motivating power for these initiated men, these great souls, these Mahatmas. And the only thing which counts with them in whatever it is that they do is whether it will be to the benefit of mankind in general or not. And something which is going to so upset them in the sorts of ways that gratuitous demonstrations of occult power would undoubtedly upset people, they wouldn't countenance for an instance. All right, you may say, well, never mind the psychic powers and so forth, why don't they come and teach us? Well, does it not seem to you that we have had a wealth of teachers over the last 100 years, and that we haven't really taken a blind bit of notice of any of them? They have been collectively, in their various forms, in their religious forms and in the forms of sorts of areas with which we are concerned, theosophy, psychism, spiritualism, and so forth, has it not been the case that we have had any number of teachers preaching doctrines of the highest purity and urging man forward to forms of humanitarian treatment of his fellows? Does it seem to you that the world has changed that much in that sort of area? Does it really seem probable that hearing it the same thing from a different mouth is actually going to achieve very much? The more I've studied this area, the more I begin to see that this would be completely and utterly pointless. What would happen is what happens already, but only 10 times worse. Already we see every leader of every spiritual movement of whatever form surrounded by what you might call spiritual groupies, who are so sentimentally and emotionally involved with what's going on that they really haven't the faintest idea what the teacher is actually saying. They are drunk with the aura of power of one form or another, whether it's the power of the human mind or the power of the psyche or whatever form it is. They are so drawn by that, they're so moved by it, they're so influenced by it, that they're not thinking clearly at all. It is easy to accumulate followers. As the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said, if you want followers, add zeros. And it's a cynical remark, but it's true. Followers prove nothing, and the intention of the teachings of such an initiate as we're talking about here would be completely drowned out by the sorts of followers and surroundings that would be inevitably attracted to such a thing. Imagine it in our day and age, what a media event the whole thing would suddenly become. And can you imagine that in the furore that would be caused in the media by such an event now, that any real spiritual teaching could be imparted, that any real benefit would actually accrue to anybody? Are these not the sorts of matters that we need to consider coolly and calmly within our own souls, quietly, without pressure, without fuss, without the rush of external events? Well, I believe that it is so, and this is certainly not what would occur if they were to, as it were, appear in Hyde Park on the television. I'd like to go back a little and take another look at the psychic phenomena that were occurring at the time that we're referring to here in the 1880s. Now, the sorts of psychic phenomena that were provided for Synod, the sorts of things that I've already described, the trouble is with these, the trouble then and the trouble today, is that it convinces nobody apart from the person that actually sees it. Now, eventually, as a result of the psychic phenomena produced for him, Synod was indeed convinced of the genuineness of the phenomena produced for him. But there are two things we can add to that. Firstly, it proves nothing to anybody else. He wrote these up in his book. He was a journalist. He wrote them up well, in very readable form. And if you've not read The Occult World as a book before, you might well find that worthwhile, if that's the sort of thing that you find interesting. It's a well-written book. It's very easy to read. It's not all that long. It certainly had the effect, as I've said, of exciting the curiosity of a large public. But, of course, it also excited quite the opposite. It excited the critics, and justifiably they came up with a whole series of explanations as to the occult phenomena that he had seen, and said that it wasn't an occult phenomena at all. It was all a load of trickery produced by Madame Blavatsky and a series of confederates. Now it comes to this. Supposing that I were to say to you, look, I'm a proficient in the occult sciences, I can produce any psychic phenomena that you like, what would you like? And more than that, I say to you, dream up an experiment which is absolutely foolproof, which, once it's happened and that you have documented it, couldn't possibly be doubted. And I think you're going to be pretty hard-pressed to do that. I don't know whether you came across it recently, but there was a lovely little fraud perpetrated recently, quite deliberately, by a group of scientists setting out to prove just exactly this. It all came in with the metal bending craze. It was done quite recently, I believe. And they sent two supposed metal benders down to, I think it was the Stanford Research Institute, but I might have got wrong. I don't want to malign anybody particularly. And these two guys set out consciously to fool the researchers. And the researchers, heaven help us, were scientists who were supposed to be impartial and to be viewing everything in just this way, and you're excluding all possible fraud and so forth. And they continued successfully to fool them for months. Not just minutes, but months. And eventually they had to say, look, you know, we're fooling you in this particular way. And scientists got egg on their faces. Now, these were guys who were supposed to be setting up things under laboratory conditions to exclude all possibilities of deception and so forth. Look how easy it was to do. So, even supposing that you came up with what you thought were the most rigorous safeguards and asked me to produce this psychic phenomenon, and I did it for you, and you said, yes, marvellous, and you publish it, and then somebody comes along and says, well, yes, but you didn't do this, did you? Maybe he did that, and, you know, you didn't think of that, did you? And lo and behold, the whole thing is vitiated. Might as well have not bothered. It proves nothing except to the person that sees it, and even then that person can be fooled as well. A good conjurer, who is after all probably a lot better trained anyway at the the way in which these things sort of be presented and misdirecting your attention and so forth can do a lot of things which might seem pretty marvellous. The sorts of magicians you see on the television appear to do things which I can't see any explanation for, I don't know about you, and they have successfully fooled me. How do you know you're not being fooled? It proves nothing. I'm not saying that it's not genuine, but what I'm saying is that to rest anything on a view of psychic phenomena proves nothing ultimately and gets you nowhere. So, as far as Sinnett was concerned, it was no more than I hate to say a bait, but that's the sort of thing I mean. It was something to satisfy his curiosity so that he could be led on to something more significant and more worthwhile. And that is indeed what happened. The correspondence in the book, the Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnett, documents the development of Sinnett's interest and the direction in which that interest went after the initial series of letters concerning occult phenomenon had taken place. And I'd like to review with you, if only briefly, some of the sorts of areas that become apparent from this set of letters. We could talk at length this evening about, are letters genuine? How do you know they were written by Mahatmas? I don't. I couldn't prove it to you any more than I could prove any psychic phenomena to you. I believe they're genuine. I believe they're written by people who are a good deal more in the know, put it crudely, than I am. But to prove it, like psychic phenomena, is to chase your tail. It gets you nowhere. You could prove it, you wouldn't be any further forward. It's what it says which is what's important, not how it was written, or whether you think they might be genuine, or whether you think they might have been forged, or if so, who by, and which ones are genuine and which ones not, and so forth. The whole thing is counterproductive. As with any of these sorts of areas, it's genuine if, when you read it, you find that they are internally consistent and what they are saying is meaningful, useful, valuable, helpful, and relates to your experience and seems to help you on in whatever development you're undertaking. And that, to me, is wherein the value of these letters lies. A number of the letters are taken up with what you might call philosophical, metaphysical teachings. It was the basis on which the whole theosophical metaphysic, shall we say, has subsequently been based. As a result of these letters, Sinnett published a series of articles in various theosophical journals at the time, and these were substantially the food on which the audience of the Theosophical Society fed for a number of years. And really, not until the publication in 1888 of The Secret Doctrine was there anything more available. But from these letters, he skillfully put together a book called Esoteric Buddhism and a series of articles which outlined, let's say no more than that, outlined the basic principles of the occult philosophy. It covered the major sorts of topics concerned with the nature of cosmos, its origin, its evolution, the constitution of man, the cycle of birth and death through which he passes, the process involving the processes of karma, the vast cyclic journey of not only man but the whole process itself is outlined in these letters and in depth. It is a challenge to anybody to read. And at this point it's perhaps also worth saying that you have to understand this in terms of a correspondence. If you set out to write a book, you set out to present your subject coherently, logically, starting from chapter one, working your way progressively through to chapter however many, and at the end of it you expect your reader or student to have understood and to have assimilated all the information, and away he goes. This, remember, was a correspondence with one man. And so the correspondence is related to the knowledge and understanding, inclinations and predispositions of that man, with an eye to the future and his use of the information. But also it is a method of instruction. It's not really a book for all to read, although all are welcome to read it, and I hope you do. But it is a book, a set of letters in which one man is being led on step by step, and as he understands more and more, so he is fed a little bit more, but he has to work for it the whole time. We have got very used, it seems to me, in our educational system and subsequently to being what we rather derogatorily call spoon-fed, and we expect somehow or other the information to be shoveled into us, open our mouths and a funnel and the whole thing poured in, and that's it. Minimum effort, maximum content. Well, it doesn't really work, even in the area of ordinary education. And certainly in this sort of area, that of the development of the inner man and his faculties, it doesn't work at all. And you are fitted to understand that which you fit yourself to understand, not which somebody can give you. There are no secrets in occult nature except those from which you exclude yourself by your lack of effort. If you are prepared to make the effort, the whole of the occult world is open to you. But you must make the effort. You must put in the effort to understand, to grow into it, you might say, rather than just understanding it with the intellect. Well, these sections in the letters dealing with these sorts of ideas lead you on gradually, and as you're prepared to puzzle them out, to think them through, to live them, to incorporate them into your worldview, so the effect of the information begins to be seen. Another large area concerned with which the letters concern themselves is that of what we might call the path of spiritual development. In the normal case, in the normal run of things, the path that we follow is known only to us and possibly to our spiritual guide, if we're lucky enough to have one. And all the trials and tribulations that we go through are private to us, and we don't really see what happens to other people. At this time, as a result of this explosion of interest, a number of people were accepted as pupils, temporary pupils, probationary pupils of these Mahatmas. And some of their doings are documented in these letters. Now, this section of the letters can easily put people off, because you see these people, warts and all, and some of them you think, God, you couldn't possibly have wanted to do that, you know, and they seem to have acted in ways which you think are so stupid, in ways which are so uncharacteristic, that I wouldn't have dreamt of doing anything like that. Well, I wonder. What you see here, if you like, is the laid open inner life of a number of people put on probation in the way as described in these letters, and what as a result happened. One of the things which to me comes out of all of this, which is fascinating and instructive, is that the whole of this development, and indeed the whole of one's relationship with these initiates, depends on your own self-sufficiency. From start to finish, if there is one thing which characterizes these letters, is that you've got to do the whole thing yourself. It's not just a message for the 1880s, it's a message for all time, it seems, from what they're saying here. And this applies at level after level. It applies at the purely personal level. If anything of what theosophy or any other spiritual discipline has to say to you appeals to you, then there's only one thing to do, and that's get up and start moving, because nobody is going to come along and help you. Once you're moving, then what people have said and what people can do will help along the way, but you must move your own 2 feet if you're to get anywhere at all. There is a Dutch proverb which reads that God helps the sailor, but he must steer himself, which is very much characteristic of this. You've got to do the work yourself, and then at key points when you have done sufficient work, then perhaps you can be helped, so to speak, just that little bit to tip the balance so that you understand more or can see your way more clearly in whatever it is that you need to do. This is very, very clear from the letters at the personal level, whether it's at the position you and I are at as mere beginners or the sorts of more advanced stages of the spiritual path as outlined in these letters, probationary stages, those being an accepted pupil or chela, as they call them. All of these are outlined, but at no point are you sort of taken into the protective custody of the adept, and you know, you can relax back and think, right, it's all downhill now, I've done all the work, you know, they can just fill me in on the details. Not a bit of it. You're going to be left on your own, you're going to have to use your own judgment, and if you make mistakes, you've got egg on your face. And more than that, it's entirely possible that you're going to fail in all of this. The odds are on, it's odds on that you're going to fail in some of these areas at some juncture along the way. It must be so. This is the way we learn. If there were somebody, as they say somewhere, to come along and sweep away the effects of the unfortunate causes that you set in motion, the whole thing would be far too easy and you'd never learn. But it's also true, this self-sufficiency, at larger and larger levels. It was clearly true of the whole of the Theosophical Society as it then was. As soon as Sinnett had managed to start up this sort of correspondence, in the first instance, what he did was to form a new branch of the society in Simla, called the Simla Eclectic Theosophical Society, and he rather expected that special favours were going to be showered upon this in some way by these adepts, and that they would help and help on in developing the psychic powers of its members and all this sort of thing. But of course none of this happened at all. And quite the reverse. They said, look, if you really want anything, work for it, deserve something, and then we might look at you again and see what's happening. But until you're prepared to do that, why do you think you deserve such special favours? You, materialistic Westerners, coming along, claiming this, when what have you done to deserve it? Absolutely zero. So in fact, that particular enterprise, based on the selfish wants and needs of a few Western inquirers, collapsed pretty rapidly. But the same thing is writ much large in the early history of the society. There are hints and clues in these letters that the whole of the society was, so to speak, on a form of probation. As to whether the Theosophical Society, and indeed the whole movement which now represents, should move forward, or whether it should die an early death, and if to move forward, then in what way? And inevitably, as a result of its constitution, its leaders, its members, the society in which it found itself, there were, you might say, almost by the way, problems that it was bound to encounter. Madame Blavatsky, by her very nature, was bound to provoke and did provoke criticism, which was virulent at the time. The genuineness of what she was doing, the genuineness of the Mahatmas, all of this was brought into question at the time, and there were all sorts of scandals and outrages and various hoofers which went on, all of which had the effect of finding out whether those who had conceived of an initial interest in this whole thing were really genuine in the thing or not. If you can be put off because somebody says, oh, Madame Blavatsky, that old fraud, you know, just a psychic, that's all. And if you think, oh, just a psychic, eh? Oh, well, that's it then. Well, if it's at that sort of level, then the whole thing doesn't deserve to go any further. Why should it? If there isn't the strength of purpose, the need, the real inner need for this sort of thing, then no amount of cultivating it is going to make it thrive. So you get hints in these letters which say, not only were we quite happy to see these crises occur, we actually helped them on. We actually made sure that they became crises for the society to see how you'd react to it. And some of them they got through okay, others they didn't. It has to be fairly said that there are some of them which should have been handled very differently from the way they were handled. And again, these are the sorts of areas that, if you're interested in, you can have a look back in the history. But really I'm concerned here with the letters. It's the letters themselves which, to me, are most interesting because of this information. So, self-sufficiency for the individual, for the society as a whole, but also, you might say this is true at the collective level, the whole of humanity. The same principle applies. You and I are in the same boat. There is one letter in which they talk of this, and they say that if you look back at the various teachers of humanity, they fall into two groups, broadly speaking. On the one hand, those who say that, relatively speaking, we're all going to get there, we're all saved, and you don't really need to make much effort, and you're going to get there in the end anyway. And the others, and this certainly characterized what the Mahatmas were saying in these letters, is that you're not necessarily going to get there in the end. The whole thing is conditional on effort. Where we are now is as a result of the efforts we've made so far in our own development, and it is a matter of pressing urgency that we should continue to make these sorts of efforts. It is the matter, they say, and they put it as strongly as this, a matter of life and death for millions as to the success or failure of organizations such as the TS. At the time they said the TS because it was the only organization of its kind, but I imagine that updating that today, we might take in the broad spectrum of sorts of spiritual movements of which we are, a key representative. Now that is a staggering statement, a matter of life and death for millions. Well, yes, because it's the inner man with which evolution is concerned. It is with the inner faculties, the development of the spiritual potential that each one of us represents, which is of paramount importance. The outer circumstances in which we live are of less importance. I say this from the wealthy background of an English society in which I do very comfortably, thank you very much. And it's easy to say when you're well fed and you're warm and you're well clothed. It's not so easy to say when you're starving and you're freezing. But nonetheless, I do still say it, that the physical circumstances are of less concern than the concern with the inner man. We begin to see just how true this is when we try and pour in physical aid in all sorts of places all over the world, and if anything, it's inclined to make the situation slightly worse, because it creates dependency and does away with any remaining vestiges of self-sufficiency that the population might have. But that's merely at one level. What we're talking about here is at the inner level of spiritual development. Now, spiritual development does not require study of esoteric books and esoteric literature. It requires, frankly, very little. But that very little, even that very little, is missing in great parts of the world today, and has done for centuries, I suspect. The message that the Mahatmas were putting across, and which to an extent the Theosophical Society has been putting across ever since, is sufficiently simple in its basic principles that anybody can understand it. And if they were to just take a few key simple ideas, there are not more than, let's say, a dozen or so key ideas which are central to the thing, and were to incorporate those into their worldview and into their daily life, indeed the world could be transformed. We don't particularly need to study the esoteric details of the thing. That comes later. We most certainly don't need to develop psychic and occult powers in order to make this thing live and grow. But what we do need is the vision, which you do get in these particular letters, of humanity as a whole family, and of our concern for it as a whole family. Throughout those letters, there is a passionate concern that the Theosophical Society does not become a cult, does not become a little self-interned society for the benefit of its own members, but that if it exists at all, it exists for the benefit however, in whatever way, in however limited an extent, for the rest of mankind. And as one of the writers of the letters said in one place, that they would far rather that the whole enterprise perish at that point than it become just another school of psychism and development of occult powers. I'd like to close this talk by just saying a word or two about who these people are that we've been talking about this evening, these Mahatmas or adepts, initiates, whatever we want to call them. I think this idea has been so misunderstood that it's led to the most absurd concepts in a number of people's minds. Maybe you don't fall into these sorts of categories, but perhaps, so let's say a word or two about it. The thing that we see about initiates and adepts is the most obvious thing, is firstly that they seem to have a series of strange and esoteric powers, psychic powers of one form or another, and that they seem to have a wealth of knowledge that we don't have, knowledge as to the nature of nature and her processes. And therefore we're inclined to judge them by our standards, saying, look, supposing I had those powers and I had that information, how would I then act? And we come up with all sorts of clever ways in which we would go about acting, which may not be entirely selfish, but nonetheless we have a fair whale of a time in one way or another. And we think, well, why don't they do that? Why don't we see them behaving in this sort of a way? And it is because we have completely misunderstood what it is that they have achieved. They say in one of these letters that the real adept is not the outer man, it's not the physical man at all, is not what we would call the personal man, personality, although they have a personality and they certainly have a physical body, but it is the development of what I would call the inner man. The inner man lives a life apart almost, and it is that which through growth and development and evolution has come to life. In most of us there is barely a flicker there of what I'm talking about, and that barely a flicker wells up as things like conscience and remorse and appreciation of altruism, these sorts of things just flicker in us. In the adept, that has, so to speak, blazed forth into light. It is a real fire burning in the shell of the personality and the outer man. These things go their way much the same way that they do with us. They have their likes and their dislikes at a personal level, as you and I do. But what they have that you don't, or I suspect you don't, and if you do, what you're doing here, is that they have this awoken within them what is the real human qualities within us. The byproduct of that is that of necessity come to life a whole series of hidden faculties, the psychic faculties, and that we that stem from it. And as a result of that, they can act and behave and influence the world and its events in quite a number of, to us, quite startling ways. For us to develop those is to develop it all the wrong way round. Yes, you can develop those psychic powers to a limited extent, but only to a limited extent, and then they become faculties of your personality. And of course you use them for personal benefit, for selfish aims and reasons and so forth. But what they have done is to have struggled and struggled and to have developed and brought into existence the inner man who sees the whole of nature, who sees the whole of humanity, not as a concept, but as a reality, who is as far removed from your viewpoint as if you were, so to speak, floating in the sea in your life jacket and being slapped in the face by a series of waves and can't really see what's going on, compared with the guy who is 1,000 feet up and can see the whole panorama and can see all the little dotted people floating about in the water, can see the movement of the currents, can see the tidal wave, can see the wind and its movement and so forth, can see all those factors, and has concern for all of those people floating in the water, and will do what he can to ameliorate the conditions of the whole, and only will act with an individual where that individual so clearly can act as an instrument for others that it becomes worthwhile to act in that particular way. This, then, is the way these people are to be viewed. So to look at them and say, what do they look like? What colour hair has he got? What are his eyes like? Oh, what lovely piercing blue eyes. This sort of thing is completely to miss the point. To look at his personality, oh, he's charming, you know, oh, wonderful aura, you know, this sort of thing, completely to miss the point. To say, what are his psychic powers? What can he do? Can he produce lovely, beautiful, precious stones out of the air and so forth? Can he heal people? You know, completely to miss the point. What the adept is a fact in nature in terms of his inner development, and as a result, he cannot help but aid and help on humanity in that sort of way. The rest of it is just as it is and is of no concern to us. You wouldn't even recognize an adept if you came and bit your nose off, because you couldn't recognize him at the level at which he is an adept. If he chose to make sure that you didn't realize this, you wouldn't have the faintest chance of recognizing it. This, then, is of the nature of the occult world.
And he will be pleased now to answer a few questions. First question, please.
Yes. I have to say that I don't think that they're likely to do this. For the following reasons, I guess. Firstly, what could such a person profitably say which other spiritual teachers have not already said and on television? What they would undoubtedly want us to do is to encourage us, you might say, to follow the path of self-development, spiritual development, and the general care for the rest of humanity in whatever way we can do that. But the keynote of all of this is that we must do it because it is we who want to do it, and not in any sense to be led into doing this because of this, that, or the other. Now, as soon as it's a because of, as soon as because it's an I say so, or I recommend so, or da-da-da-da, then inevitably there is a central figure in the whole thing about which the whole thing revolves. Supposing such a person were to stand up and say, look, I am the mouthpiece of such and such a Mahatma, and he asks me to go on television and to say this, that, and the other. What's the producer going to say? He says, well, produce your Mahatma. I don't believe you. Why should I believe you? What you say is of any more significance than what anybody else says. If you couldn't produce your Mahatma, you'd be dead as far as the media are concerned anyway. So that, you know, that's not going to get you anywhere. And if you could produce him, they'd say, well, why can't he go on in your stead? So you're going to get nowhere here. Even if you were to overcome all of these sorts of problems, the problem in all of these things, looking at it in a much wider context, is that anything which revolves round a central figure means that it's detracting effort from the individual who is the follower, who is inspired by what the person says, from what he should be doing until what he thinks he ought to be doing. In other words, it's inspired by a movement, a person, an ambience, whatever it happens to be, rather than because on my own two feet, because I can see nothing better to do, that I choose this particular path and I will tread it to the end. If you don't start in that sort of way, then with the death of your leader, or if some scandal comes along, or if something else happens, your confidence in him is shaken, and you think, oh no, that wasn't right all along. And the baby gets thrown out with the bathwater, and all the good things that he or she may have said will then get discarded along with the unsatisfactory personal nature of whoever the teacher happens to have been. And for that sort of thing, I can give you numerous instances. Ultimately, it's because we've got to do it ourselves, and because they do not want to detract from that, that I don't believe it will ever happen.
Is there another question? Last question over there.
This business of the disbelief of people in the genuineness of the Mahatma letters at the time, I do recall reading that H.P. Blavatsky was also the butt of a lot of
It's not something on which I would like to express a very strong opinion, because my knowledge of things Eastern in that sort of area is not that great. My impression, for what it's worth, is that the general nature of the religions of India, let's say, and Southeast Asia, is such as to inculcate an acceptance of such people as adepts and so forth. It fits into their whole structure very much more easily than it does into ours, the tradition in the Hindu of the rishis and so forth as the teachers of mankind, into Buddhism as the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and so forth, as the sort of the man made holy through effort, is there as a basic concept. In a sense, sometimes it gets a bit elaborated with the mysterious and fabulous powers with which they are endowed and so forth. But nonetheless, the root of the idea, I think, is there. And I think you would find that there is, broadly speaking, a wide acceptance of this. At the time that all this was taking place, what I've been talking about this evening, in the members of the society who were Indian, broadly speaking, there was, it seems, a wide acceptance of the fact of the Mahatmas as being involved with the society. Surprised, perhaps, that they should be involved in what was basically seen as a Western society, but nonetheless involved. In the East, in the West, as you say, skepticism, ridicule, and all the rest that goes with it. However, may I just add as a little footnote to that, that in one place in their letters they say, frankly, they couldn't care less. Well, more than that, the fact that they're not believed in was positively encouraging. They were delighted with the fact. They didn't want people to believe in them. They weren't looking for acceptance in the sense that I might have been talking this evening. The way they put it is that the less people accept this as a matter of fact and of course and so forth, the more it will encourage honest inquiry, the more it will leave people self-motivated to find out for themselves, to develop their inner natures without some sort of hero or ideal or god out there who they're looking to do something for them. When they think they've got to do it themselves, they're much better motivated to do it than if they think that somewhere up there, out there, over there, who's going to help them in some sort of way. So it didn't worry them, the fact that their names and very existence was called into question, indeed ridicule.